The Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011. We're going to get moving. I see Senator Vanderveer has showed up. So the first item on the agenda is Senate File 128, a bill authored by Senator Ray Vanderveer providing matching grants. For a disabled veterans camp on Big Marine Lake. So, Senator Vanderveer, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to be here. If somebody could move the bill, if you're ready.
Mr. Chair, move the bill.
Senator Daley, move Senate File 128. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill does is provides matching grants for improvements to the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp in Big Marine. It's a camp that's been there for, hold on.
85 years.
And here to discuss it with you and tell you what they do at the camp is the president, Al Mitchell, and he's going to describe kind of what they do, what they've been doing with the money. If you haven't been out to the camp, you should come out and see, because all the money that is donated or has been granted to the vets camp by the state, if you would see how much they accomplish with very little money, because they have tremendous volunteer help that come out there. So why don't you go ahead, Alan?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, at this time I would like to, if I may, move it over to one of my board members, Lori Alness, who has a few things she'd like to say in reference to the Yellow Ribbon Program, and then after that, Colonel Alness will bring his respects from the, as far as the guards and what they have achieved for us.
All right. Thank you very much. Please state your name.
Hi, Lori Alness, and I'm a veteran of the military, 25 years, and I represent the American Legion on the Board of Directors for the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp.
All right, welcome.
Okay, thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I understand that the committee has been provided a two-page summary on the camp programs, and I'd like to highlight a few points. First, the camp has seen a surge of visitors. In the last 3 years alone, the amount of visitors to the camp has increased every year by an additional approximately 2,000 members. This year, the camp is expecting about 12,000 visitors. This growth has required upgrading and expansion of our 85-year-old campground, along with its recreation and trail facilities. Second, many of those campers and visitors to the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp are from out of state. Some even staying the entire summer. This is a tremendous amount of veterans congregating in Minnesota, which is an economical benefit to the community and to Minnesota as a whole. Third, the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp is the only Yellow Ribbon camp in the United States. We have worked hard to have our action plan for taking care of veterans and their families and their friends be accepted by both the military and the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is the nation's leader for encouraging businesses, organizations, churches, and even entire counties to become Yellow Ribbon. And the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp recognized it as important to partner with these many public and private entities to care for our veterans. Lastly, because the camp is recognized by the public as being a successful reintegration venue for the veterans, we have had many organizations step forward to offer their assistance to upgrade and expand the camp. To date, much of that assistance has been in the form of donated time and labor to build a central pavilion and to build handicap accessible cabins. That donated time and labor alone is over $500,000. The materials, however, have to be purchased by the camp. And now these facilities need to be finished, furnished, and even landscaped before they can safely be rented out. And to provide additional safety, a combined used shower slash shelter needs to be constructed. For these reasons, we respectfully ask for a matching grant of $500,000 be approved to continue this 85-year tradition of the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp to take care of our veterans and their loved ones. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for? All right, let's proceed. Please state your name.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Colonel Eric Alness, I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota National Guard, and I'd like to talk to just 3 points here. The first one is the yellow ribbon designation that the camp has received. That's one of 41 entities in the state that has achieved this benchmark, and really it is a benchmark designation showing that these organizations, and when I say organizations, they're cities, counties, companies, which a camp is a nonprofit organization, a company, and college campuses have achieved a measure of distinction by saying they will go above and beyond what is required, and really what many other people do out of the goodness of their heart. They even go a step beyond that to make it a welcoming community or a welcoming business for veterans. And they've gone through the extensive work plan process and have it vetted and sent back to them to ask to do more. To how can they better reach out to all the veterans that are in the state or in the region to help make this a welcoming state for veterans. As a result, the governor designated that as Yellow Ribbon Company last year. So I just want to talk about the importance and the power of the Yellow Ribbon designation and that this camp has achieved that status. The second thing is that the National Guard, we've invested a significant amount of work in this camp as well. Over the last two summers, we sent an engineer company there, a vertical engineer company. When we say vertical, they're the ones who build things like buildings and carpenters and plumbers and electricians and so forth. It's called the Innovative Readiness Training Process. And what it is obviously we can't compete with civilian contractors. That would be against federal rules. But in instances where it's adding value to the community and other than our involvement, it won't get constructed, we can get involved. So working with partners in organized labor and with the camp, we've been able to send that engineer company there to work on really important training that otherwise they wouldn't be able to get. As a result, now they have some really nice duplexes, handicap accessible duplexes available to them. Now, we're not sending them here this summer for a number of reasons. One of it is they have to do other training as well, but also because the materials have to be provided at no cost because obviously the federal government can't invest in materials and so forth. So there needs to be that new stockage of materials brought up, and which this here also addresses to some measure. And then finally, we just want to talk to that the need does not go away. We've talked about in the past that there's been 20,000 veterans from the Minnesota National Guard alone since 9/11. And right now we're in a little bit of a lull. We got less than 300 soldiers and airmen deployed, but that number is going to climb again. As we hit next fall, we'll be somewhere around 2,500 soldiers and airmen once again. So the need continues, as does a need for camps and other yellow ribbon efforts such as this. That concludes my briefing. Prior to any questions.
Do we have any questions? Maybe, Mr. Mitchell, maybe you could give us just some ideas about how this camp compares with what we normally see around the area as a resort or campgrounds. Is there something you could explain?
Very good. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Al Mitchell. I'm the president of the board for the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp on Big Marine Lake. I'm a combat disabled veteran of the Vietnam War, and I have a lot of pride in this place, like a lot of other veterans do. And how we compare with others, we compare that we are a campsite offering recreation. And the difference that makes us is that it's strictly for veterans, any veteran. All veterans took that solemn oath to uphold their country and their flag and everything. And I'm from that era where the veteran really, I was one of those veterans that had to take my uniform off when I came back from Vietnam in the bathroom and go on an aircraft to my next destination because I got abused with verbal abuse and everything else, and I just couldn't stand it. I don't want to ever see that happen again. And our camp is a place for that group of veterans, all veterans, whatever, if they're combat or not, that can come up there and have a home and be welcomed by other veterans and their families and mix together and enjoy themselves and relax. There is a little story I like to share. One time with a veteran, one time we were sitting in our little favorite watering hole we have up there. We call it, affectionately called the canteen, and it's about as old as, well, it is as old as the camp. And it's a wonder it still stands, and we should probably use that for a storm shelter because it's never blown down. But anyway, I was sitting in there one time with one of the veterans, and he says, you know, Al, he says, that happened again. And I says, what's that? And he says, you know, when I turned off the highway onto that dirt road coming into the camp, as I had a warm feeling come over me like I was home again. And, you know, and I thought I was the only one that had that feeling. And so it's something, it's a camaraderie, it's a little different, you know. I'm hoping I'm answering your question. You know, it's still a recreational place. We have boats, we have docks, we have hiking trail, we have paths, we have, you know, the beautiful lake to fish in and everything else, and we have RVs and we have cabins and everything else. And so, but the difference is it's strictly for the veterans of the United States and especially from Minnesota, and we get them from all over the country.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thank you. Mitchell. Senator Vanderveer, tongue-tied there for a moment. I understand there's a possibility that this project may be eligible for legacy funding, and would it be your intention to send this bill, this legislation, over to Environment Committee for consideration?
If we could, Mr. Chair, we're not certain that that's going to happen, but I think it could be helpful, and we could... at least I think sending it there would give us the opportunity to pursue that.
All right. Okay.
So if you could do that. And, Mr. Chair, Lori Arnes wanted to just add a couple more things, if that would be all right.
Sure, something else what makes this camp different is I'm not sure if you recognize that our last names are the same. This is my husband. I'm surprised. I didn't know he was going to be here yesterday or today.
I was going to say, Miss. I thought maybe daughter would have been better, but that's...
Well, my husband's going to be deployed this year. Always and campaign. This is a place... This is a place where families go, and I want to emphasize it's not only for the veterans, but it's for the families and friends of military veterans, because friends can get sponsored there. And I know that I can go there with our 15-year-old daughter, and she's going to be in contact with other kids, other teens who are experiencing something similar or who have. That's a welcome relief for me, knowing that as a veteran, I'm going to be with other veterans. But more importantly, since I've been retired from 2002, that I'm going to be with other families.
Thank you very much. Senator Dibble, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Just a process question, Mr. Chair, for Senator Vanderveer. You know, this represents an appropriation either from the general fund or maybe it'll represent an appropriation from the legacy resources. Is our intention to make this a part of the budget process or to travel this bill on its own? See, someone's talking in your ear there.
Senator Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I apologize. I can't hear three things at once.
I'm just wondering about, you know, this is a great, you know, I'm very supportive. I'm happy to see this come before the committee and happy to do what I can to help this. But I'm just wondering in terms of process, in terms of the budget process, how we're handling this.
Well, I think the for my part, I know in the House they're doing similar, and I just felt that it might be a good idea to move this over just to see what would happen once it got over to Environment and see what their thoughts were.
And Mr. Chair, that's I'm comfortable with that. I'm just leery of putting spending measures out on the floor absent. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't do that typically. I mean, I've never seen it actually, that we do a spending bill absent, you know, the whole budget.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I agree with you, and I think more than likely because the bill was here, and just if we send it to the other committee, it could still end up, you know, in the omnibus bill, and I don't see it going directly to the floor by itself. Okay,
thank you. So.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Vanderveer, Mr. Mitchell, can you just talk briefly about the $375,000 for the shower house storm shelter and the $500,000 grant that we're looking at? What the other $125,000 might be spent on?
Sewer and septic.
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell.
The grant, you know, the grant that we're asking for to build this storm shelter shower facility. We don't have a place for the residents to go to in a case of a storm. We have sidewalks, road improvements. We have handicap accessible docks we have to put in. Other things that we have furnishings for our cabins. We have one cabin that is fully handicap accessible, so we have to buy special things for that for wheelchair recipients, and so it'll be spread out all over the place, but mainly for the shower slash storm shelter. But also because where we're going to have to locate it, we have to put in another well and some other things up there that bring in a lot of costs, and it's really hard to get those things done through donations that we get throughout the state at $100 a whack, and so we're hoping for this grant to help us with some of the other, or this matching fund, because we are getting grants from other organizations and foundations out there that we're doing. One of our members, our treasurer for the board, Don Driggins, is very active along with Lori in getting these grants out there, and so this would help us to be able to get more money based on you know, what you give us, and then we match it with another grant, so that it gives us even more.
Senator Daley, I think also we should know that these are released in $100,000 increments. So as they raise that, then
matching grant,
matching, correct, right? Senator Wigger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to express strong support for the camp. I've been a co-author on earlier versions of this, and I've visited the camp. I know the hope that it provides, the needed time out in one's life. The yellow ribbon designation is so appropriate. It's also good for tourism with all the many people, and to ask for handicap accessibility and toilets, we have to do that. So hopefully there is going to be funds when we get to the end of this.
All right. Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 128 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
Senator Daley has moved that Senate File 128 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Any further discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rich. Very much. Appreciate it.
Next item on the agenda is presentation on the functions and budget for the Office of Governor Mark Date. Have documents being passed out right now, so Ms. Smith, I'll let you introduce yourself. And
great, thank you very much, Chair Perry, members of the committee. My name is Tina Smith, and I am Chief of Staff for the Office of Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Yvonne Pretner-Solon. And I have with me today Paula Brown, who is Director of Operations for our office. I'd like to note that Ms. Brown has very ably served the office of the governor in three administrations, beginning in the Ventura administration and then the Pawlenty administration and now ours. So we're very fortunate to have her expertise with us in the governor's office. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present our information before you today about the governor's office and our budget. I thought I would speak very briefly and then answer any questions that you have. We have two handouts for you today. The first is an overall summary of the functions of the governor's office and our budget, the governor's budget recommendations. And the second is a historical look at the biennial budget of the Office of the Governor, including some background information about the history of the employees in the office, which I thought would provide us some good context. Let me start by saying that, just as a review of our budget, that Governor Dayton has proposed a budget for the governor's office of $7.7 million over the biennium. This represents a 5% reduction in the general fund budget for our office from fiscal year 2010 and 11. That budget includes $6.4 million from the general fund and another $1.3 million from the special revenue fund. I'll take a minute to explain how that works, for a total of $7.7 million. A couple of observations about the governor's office budget. As you can see from the historical trend line, the governor's office budget, at least since 1996, has been supported by both general fund and special revenue fund dollars. And the special revenue fund dollars have historically been used to support some of the policy work in the governor's office. Our goal here today was to be as transparent as we possibly could about the total budget for the governor's office so that you could see it clearly. You'll also note that the governor's budget recommendation for our office is a 5% reduction to the general fund, as I mentioned a moment ago. And this is consistent with Governor Dayton's direction to state agencies overall. I'd like to also highlight that this is a reduction of roughly 13% overall from 2008, which was sort of the high point in the size of the governor's office. And all of these dollars, by the way, are not adjusted for inflation. They're in actual dollars. The governor's office, I'd also like to point out, in terms of the full-time employees in the governor's office, that we are currently at a full-time employee level of about 41.5. We are anticipating that that number, with a 5% reduction, would drop down to somewhere in the neighborhood of 38. As you can imagine, for a budget of a department or an office of our size, the vast majority of the operating expenses in our budget are for staff. That number of roughly 38 full-time employees, just for your information, is compared with sort of a high water mark during the Ventura administration of roughly 55 folks. The Pawlenty administration averaged about 44 full-time employees, just as for point of comparison. Now, in the governor's office, as you have asked, Chair Perry, I wanted to provide you with just an overview of what we do in the governor's office. The purpose of our work is to support the work of the governor and the lieutenant governor, as in overseeing all the operations of state government, shaping public policy, and representing the interests of Minnesotans. We in the governor's office oversee day-to-day operations of state government. We manage 24 cabinet-level departments and 59 non-cabinet-level executive branches. We fill judicial vacancies and also appoint roughly 1,300 citizens to about 140 boards and commissions. We respond to roughly 100,000 constituent and citizen requests for help and support during the course of the year. The governor also serves as chair of the State Board of Investment, as you know, the Land Exchange Board, and the Board of Pardons. He serves as commander-in-chief of the Minnesota National Guard and oversees emergency response for the state. And he also, as you well know, develops the biennial budget for your consideration in the legislature. I'd also like to say that Governor Dayton has directed me and all of our staff to focus on improving what value the public gets from its investment in government services. This is a direction that he's given to us throughout the entire state agencies, but it also applies to our office as well. In our office, where we have been for roughly 2 months, we have already started to try to focus on improving efficiencies and modernizing our office. And to that end, we have already implemented a couple of things to accomplish that. One of the things that we've done is to change the office hours in the governor's office at the governor's direction from 7:30 to 5:30 to make it more accessible to the public. We've also updated our email system, which means, in effect, that we have moved over to the email system that the rest of state government uses rather than having our own independent system. We've monetized our phone system and have also moved to the state's eFax system. Our general feeling is that the governor's office should be served by the same systems that the rest of state government is served by. With that in mind, with that very brief overview, I'd be happy to stand for any questions that you have about the Office of the Governor or our budget, and I will do so with the expertise of Ms. Brown, who's with me today.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question, and I'm not sure who to address it to. On the governor's office, the expenditure by program, could you explain a little bit? I see that's about a little over $8 million for the biennium. Could you explain what all is included in that? Is that just office space or?
Please state your name.
Hi, I'm Paula Brown, Director of Operations with the governor's office. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, our budget, I'm not clear if you're looking at a particular page I might want to reference.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Ms. Brown, it's on page 4 of the handout that you gave us. And at the bottom, expenditures by program, governor's office.
Okay, yes. The bulk of the $8 million has supported the staff within the governor's office, the expenses we pay for rent, telecommunications. We've had in the past Federal Affairs Office. We've had the residents. The governor's residence is covered under this budget. So it's really staff and all of the operating expenses within the office at the Capitol and at the governor's residence on Summit Avenue.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said a federal office. Is that Do we have an office that we pay for in Washington? Or
We currently do not have an office in D.C.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Ms. Brown, maybe when we talk about special revenue income, can you explain that for some folks that might not know where that comes from?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, prior to fiscal year 10, the special revenue fund didn't exist as it is today, but we did, the office did utilize the interagency agreement process as a mechanism to fund portions of some of the positions within the governor's office. And that was done by working with agencies and identifying areas where we were working closely and providing direct support to the work that the agencies were doing. And through the interagency agreement process, the some of these agencies would transfer money to the governor's office to help support some of that work. Traditionally, it included funding for the Washington, D.C. office, the policy work within the legislative and policy area, and funded a groundskeeper at the governor's residence. In fiscal year 10, the legislature created this special revenue fund and through that fund directed the governor's office to deposit all of those funds into the special revenue fund, so I believe so that the money could be better tracked and there would be more transparency in what the cost was to operate the governor's office.
Could you give us a couple more examples of where, like, who would you be working with and how it would be charged?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly. The Department of Administration has for decades covered the cost of a groundskeeper position at the residence. So in that example, the Department of Administration has always provided full funding for that position. That money now goes into the special revenue fund to fund the groundskeeper at the residence. Another example would be our policy people. A portion of their salary and fringe benefits costs have been charged to the agencies that they provide direct work with and support to. So there might be a policy advisor who has four or five agencies that they're working with. We would apportion out a percentage of their salary to each of those agencies.
All right. Any other questions? All right. I guess not. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The next item on the agenda is presentation on the functions and budget for the Office of State Auditor, Rebecca Ottawa.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Rebecca Otto, the Minnesota State Auditor. So nice to be in front of you today. Matt's going to quickly plug in our presentation, and we've been working with Elizabeth from your committee trying to get this all together today in time for you. So I have a PowerPoint that I'm going to share with you with some nice graphics. I know the committee, from your instruction, Mr. Chair, we're interested in what we do to really make Minnesota better and innovate, because we need to be looking at that in government always, every day. And so I wanted to give you some examples of that, but before, as Matt gets the presentation up, the Office of the State Auditor, I am elected statewide. It's a constitutional office. I'm a constitutional officer, and I'm serving in my second term. The 30,000-foot view is our office of a staff of approximately 110, 115 oversees over $20 billion per year or $40 billion for the biennium. So for the number of people and the amount of money we oversee, we run a pretty efficient shop in Minnesota. Ohio has about 2,000 auditors to do their work, and so we're very slender in Minnesota, but we are doing the work for the people. You ask about the mission of our office, because we're not an agency. We're an independent office. And the mission of our office is to oversee that $20 billion and ensure that we provide transparency of that $20 billion per year spent by local governments. All right. We have encrypted lockdown memory sticks, I'll call them. So we're very serious about security and protecting non-public data in our office, which is really important. There was a couple of security breaches in our office before I took office, and so we have pretty much locked everything down, which is, again, something we need to do for Minnesotans to protect their private information. We're almost there. You have the PowerPoints in front of you, correct? Is that right, Liz? Okay, thank you. Can I have yours and I'll just use it? Or actually, I've got one. Okay, let's proceed. Let's go to it'll be slide 3, innovation. So every day, the Office of the State Auditor and my staff, we focus on and reevaluate how we conduct our business with an eye to efficiency, innovation, and transparency. How can we do even more and better oversight? The first thing I start with is being proactive and preventative. Rather than just letting these local governments get into trouble and having to clean up that mess, let's keep them from getting into trouble. So we do all that we can with education, online e-newsletter every week with little helpful hints for them, reminding them about reporting deadlines to our office. We collect a lot of financial information. You wanted to know about major innovation, and I'll tell you a quick example. We oversee tax increment finance districts, which is basically a subsidy program, and we use it for economic development in Minnesota. And, you know, the office has collected information for a really long time, and it's been the same information. And when I got there, somebody said to me, well, a lot of this data is, well, it's not great, and it's not really specific, and it's guesstimates. And I said, well, why are we collecting it? Well, it's because that's the way the law was set up. And I said, well, if it's not really useful data for the legislature and it's confusing for the public and it's based on guesstimations, why aren't we doing something better? So we went to the legislature, I think it was 2 years ago now, and asked them for a major overhaul of what data we're collecting. Because frankly, local governments are hiring consultants to fill out our forms to give us data that's not that useful. And so we asked for changes in statute. We got the changes. We're now doing a major overhaul of the reporting forms, And we have worked with local government people who have to report it. We did a survey of what kind of financial systems are you using, so we make sure we match up what they've got. We've also been in communication with the private sector, some of those consultants, to say, does this make sense? We let people weigh in before we build systems. And so we're a good portion of the way through that. Here's the good news. Local governments will probably save money in hiring consultants. The consultants will still probably be there for parts of it. We're going to have better data for the legislature, and the level of auditing that we can do is a much, much higher level, because then we're working with actual rather than guesstimates. So that's the kind of innovation that I look for as state auditor, to improve Minnesota, to improve oversight, and improve the data that we're collecting. We collect financial information from over 3,300 units of local government on an annual, if not more often, basis. If you think about all those officials having to fill out those forms, when I got in, there were forms that were confusing, that took a lot of time to fill out. They were hiring consultants. And or sometimes there was a problem with the integrity of the data. Our staff reviews it. And so what I said was, well, are there ways we can simplify those forms? Well, we have. When you simplify forms and we've pre-populated with data from the year before, you have better data integrity, and you save local governments time. Well, if they each save a half hour, hour here and there, it all adds up to real money, depending on the size of the entity. And then the legislature gave us a big new responsibility last year with no money, which was unfortunate. I made a decision as the auditor. It's all around forfeitures, you know, criminal forfeitures and final disposition. If you all remember the gang strike force, I kind of brought that to light. We collect information on forfeiture activity in Minnesota for criminal forfeitures, and the laws were overhauled, and we got a whole bunch of new reporters. Well, the reporters that we had, these are law enforcement officials, would give us stuff, but my staff spent a lot of time cleaning up the data. So we decided as an office to prioritize our time and our resources to create, which is really neat, a system that not only they can report on, which will give us much better data because we have drop-down menus for things that they've forfeited or they've seized, but we also, we created a dynamic tracking system for all law enforcement in Minnesota for their forfeitures. They can go in daily, by the minute, to go in and track their forfeitures, modify them, edit them if they need to. And so we built something that, with very little time or resources, that helped the whole state. So we really have an impact on a daily basis on local government and really the citizens who pay the taxes. Let's see here. We still collect some paper documents. Almost everything's electronic, but we oversee over 700 fire and police relief associations, their pension funds. We need their bylaws, investment policies, meeting minutes, broker certification forms, because we certify them for fire state aid. I don't want to handle all the paper anymore. We don't have any more room for filing cabinets. And so we're going to be able to suck those things up electronically very soon. It's a much more efficient thing. The staff doesn't have to handle all the paper. And so these are the kinds of things, again, that we look at on a daily basis. Our website, my staff used to get a lot of what I call mundane calls. They were very basic calls. Well, what's TIF? What's this? What's that? I said, let's get a website everybody can use. I had to bring in volunteer labor to help us reformat our website, and then our database people went in, our person went in and created the databases to go with it. So when local officials have to work with us, they don't pull their hair out. I've seen too many bald heads around the state of local officials. You know, they've all been pulling their hair out. So I said, let me fix it for you so you can find the information, find the forms, whatever you need. Private sector uses our stuff. A lot of CPA firms come in and look at our information. They can find it now. Researchers, the nonpartisan House research folks need to come on and grab data from our website. Lawmakers, come on. I've gotten compliments from private sector, the public, CPA firms saying thank you. So, again, it's about saving time and saving money. Improving software. Do you have the most current software? So when we conduct audits, and that's most of my office, we're having to replace our electronic work papers for audits. We are having our staff look at all the options. I've also interacted with all other state auditors. What are you using? If we're going to make an investment, because we need to, because it's now old and it's not going to work anymore with our new system, we're testing. We need the best and most efficient system to get our work done. So again, it's the value for the taxpayers, and it's getting the work done, the oversight that the public really expects. Because what we do is we work to make sure there's integrity with all taxpayer dollars that are collected and spent. Finally, our desks used to be these big wooden desks, but we have to think forward. And so really for our auditors and our staff, our desks are now our computer screens. So a really basic change we made to improve productivity was to get double screens, because those are our desks now. And for auditors and for the folks analyzing finances in our offices, it made a huge difference for their productivity because we typically get more work, not less. We're trying to, you know, we maintain the same amount of staff. But since I've been in offices, and now my fifth year I'm going into, I've been able to respond and be there for usually the needs of the taxpayers, the public, and local governments. Okay, so I'll take a breath. All right, and we will proceed with the presentation. And I'm not going to do, I will skip through the slides. You have them for your information because I know I have 20 minutes to present, so I'm going to keep moving if that's okay. How am I doing, Liz? I'm okay. As the state auditor, you serve on six state boards. You have quite the fiduciary duty because you serve on the para board as well as the state board of investment, housing finance, rural finance, executive council, land exchange. The governor told me I was the hardest working constitutional officer. I have no legislative liaison. I am the person, so I work hard for my money that I am paid by the citizens. I have to manage my staff of approximately 110 to 115. I did receive a National Excellence and Accountability Award from my peers around the country. And I'm lined up to be president of the organization, so they believe in, I push the federal government when I feel it's necessary, when I think that they're pushing unfunded mandates down onto either our local governments, which does happen. I've spoken to GASB before. I said, can you guys please be careful when you put out new accounting standards? Because a lot of our governments, our smaller governments, it's expensive for them if they have to hire new staff, do new trainings and all of that. So I've had a burger with GASB and tried to encourage them to slow down and really think about the impact they have on the smaller governments when setting standards. We do lots of stuff, and so I don't want to spend too much time. We do financial compliance audits. We do the statewide single audit report. Something you might be interested in, we don't audit all local government, mostly counties and the three cities of the first class. Taxpayers can do petition audits, and so if they're unhappy with their local government, even if they get their annual audit, which they do, they ask us sometimes to come in, and we're getting more and more of those. That's their right as Minnesotans to do that, and so we've been getting more petitions. Yes?
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Otto, how many counties are currently bidding out their annual audit?
Ms. Otto. I don't know the exact number. I can get back to you on that.
Could you guesstimate, please?
I would prefer not to. I would prefer not to. We audit most of the counties. There were some counties that were let off in 2003 due to a cut that occurred in that office. And so there's a process for the counties to, if they would like to work with a private auditor. But it's up to our professional judgment as to whether they do or not.
What is, Mr. Chair?
Senator Daley.
What is the specific criteria you consider to allow counties to bid their annual audit?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, I'm here to present my budget. I'd really like to get through it, and then if we can go to those questions, because I'm not sure if I could do my budget, that would be great, because I think that's what we're focused on today. I don't have the answer for you right now. It's based on our professional judgment, Senator Daley. And it's auditors. It's not, you know, they're not political people. It's auditors, and they base it on many factors.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
If I may, the question is very germane to your budget conversation, discussion, because counties are saving significant dollars when they're able to bid this out. And you could save a significant amount of money if you allowed the counties to do that, arguably. And we could debate this, but it is germane to your budget. So at some point, I think it's an important conversation to have.
Ms. Otto?
Mr. Chair, I'll proceed. So we publish a lot of financial information for the taxpayers, so there's transparency in local government finances. And frankly, there's a push for more transparency at the moment, not less. There are people that would like to see every check written in local government. It would be a substantial investment for the state, and we're not able to do that at this time. So we oversee lots of pension funds that support our public safety system, tax increment finance. We do best practices. We work with the firefighters to maintain our volunteer system in Minnesota to stay efficient and low cost. We do lots of special investigations, up to 4,300 units. We have to do investigations if something has gone wrong, misuse of funds. And I will let you take a look at that. This is real value to the taxpayer. If money is taken, taxpayers need to know their money is protected, and we work to help local governments do that. But when something has gone wrong, with the fine work of my staff, we do the forensic audit, not on all of them. Lots of private firms do these as well. But of the ones we've done, my staff has put together such good materials that the county attorneys have successfully convicted throughout the state. You might recognize some of the communities. They may be in your area, but some of the dollar amounts are very large. And there's been successful conviction charging and time served and money paid back, and that's what we need to do. The last biggest one, that we did was the Center for Training and Careers, which involves schools. It was they decided not to charge, but we're making legislative recommendations because it was a very unfortunate situation. Fraud reporting is up, not down. We continue to see the activity grow. So there's more need for oversight in an economic downturn, not less. We do lots of educational outreach. We even train the private CPA firms. This stuff isn't taught in the schools. Governmental accounting is very different, and governmental auditing is very different than private sector. There's no connection. And so we are there as a resource for all the private folks. We work in concert with each other and as a team. For my budget, just for a visual for you, almost 90% of our budget is simply, it's staff. It's just people. We're very proud of the fact that our other overhead costs are very, very low. If you look at the percentages, I'm proud. And so it's salaries and benefits that we support with our staff. That's what we pay for with our budget. And so if you look at it by division, the audit practice division is the largest division that we have. It's the majority of our work in the OSA. And we have the other divisions. You'll see JobZ is 0%, which I'll explain in a moment. Constitution is 2.7. So government information is where they collect and analyze over 3,000 units of local government's financial information. Plus, we support financial software for all the towns and small cities in the state. So when you make an appropriation, the blue and the yellow wedges of the pie are actually over 80% of the money that you appropriate to our office in our budget, we will replace it with fees. So you give us money, and we put the money back. So only about 17.2% of our budget is actually you don't get the money back for, okay? So if I do that in dollar amounts, you'll see that it's about 3.349 in terms of the total impact we have on the general fund. Everything else is replaced because we're required by statute to recover our costs for the audits.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
Ms. Otto, where does that money come from?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, as I just stated, the state statute requires that that we recover our costs from the auditees, the clients that we audit.
Are the counties,
Senator Daley.
Are the counties part of the group that you're referring to?
Ms. Otto.
Senator Daley, yes, absolutely. The counties are the implementation branch of state government. And the reason why there's a state auditor's office to begin with, it's a constitutional office, not a legislative office. I am elected statewide. And the reason why we audit the counties and the three cities of the first class is because they get an extraordinary amount of state money. And so that's why we are there. And we're very independent. We're not out for profit. We're there for the taxpayer and the taxpayer only. Now, we all follow governmental accounting standards, which is very important. But our job is to be there for the taxpayer. And I'm back for a second term, so I think people like what I'm doing.
Ms. Otto, can you, when you do the audits, how do you base the fees you charge the cities, the counties, and how are they comparable with what the cities and counties could do in the private sector with the audits?
Mr. Chair and members, the question of comparing costs, private sector firms typically don't publish their rates. You really won't find that. What you can find is, for instance, the private sector is going to be increasing beginning auditor salaries in 2011. We just found this published. By 2 or 3%. So they pay more than we do. We can't compete with them. And we're not out for a profit, so there's no profit margin. We're simply the cost. And as you saw, our overhead costs are very low. So when we charge an audit fee, it has to be for our costs and our costs only. That would include transportation, although we're cutting down on windshield time, which is great. We don't just have offices in the metro. We actually have them around the state so that we can serve our greater Minnesota clients. But we are going to online meetings when we, you know, for some of our meetings with our audit clients. You still have to do some on-site work. So let's say when the salary negotiations occur, we don't have any control over that. But when the state negotiates the contracts with the employees, Sometimes they go up, sometimes they're down. So depending on what happens with that, and then depending on the mix of our staff, let's say we have a retirement and someone's paid higher, you know, that can change. So we only recover our costs. Our audit fees, I believe for the last 2 years, have been flat. So the clients have not seen an increase in audit fees, which has been wonderful for them. It's always fun to send them a letter saying 0% increase because it helps them. But just like, you know, private firms, I had a private business for 10 years. I come from private sector. And depending on how much you're paying your employees and your overhead costs and your fuel costs, you know, it's the same thing for them. They'll base their fees as well. Now, is there a study showing that it's always cheaper to go with private? No. There's not a study, so it's hard to say, oh, absolutely, they always get a better deal. I don't know of local governments that are pushing for what it sounds like Senator Daley is interested in, which is, you know, well, wouldn't it be so much better and save them so much money? I'll tell you, the private firms that we work hand-in-hand with, we help them quite often. We have a good partnership going. We're a team. We do it together. There's lots of work to go around. You know, they do their work, we do ours. You know, is there some work that isn't always as good? I had a few entities say, well, we think it'd be cheaper, but we know they're less picky than you guys. They don't care about the fact that we're following the laws. Well, then that audit is not in compliance with what needs to be done. So we have to be here because they do have to follow the laws. They do have to follow contracting and bidding laws. So private sector businesses are treated fairly, because we'll have folks call and say, we don't think that they follow the bid laws. And, you know, and we don't think we got a fair shake. We think that, you know, they're relatives, and can you guys check on that? That's the kind of thing that we check on for private sector folks. So anyway, long and the short of it, there isn't a study comparing rates. When I was in private sector, when things went south, the managing partners or the owners just don't take home as much, you know, and you try to hang on to your people. So, and in government, we're not out for a profit. We're simply out for overseeing taxpayer dollars. So if that helps.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
Ms. Otto, if that is the case, you're looking out for the taxpayer, then to me it would make sense that you may consider doing RFPs and bid it out, and if including state auditor. So whoever is the lesser cost entity, that's who you go with because it costs the taxpayer less. And in statute, in Minnesota Statute 2010, Section 648, if you're concerned about these private sector companies not doing it correctly, you have oversight. If the audit's performed by a private certified public accountant, the state auditor may require additional information from the private CPA as the state auditor deems in the public interest. So you have that oversight already. It's already in statute. So that there really isn't a concern.
Ms. Otto?
Mr. Chair, can I proceed, please? I want to get through the budget so you guys know the numbers that you're dealing
fine.
With. That's
fine. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much. So these are the different divisions, and this is our proposed budget. So the bottom line being total general fund appropriation, this is the governor's, which was basically holding us flat at $19,511,000 for the biennium. We do have constitutional and statutory responsibilities. I'm going to keep going quickly here. I have two change items here for you today. My job is to come to the legislature as a constitutional officer to let you know what I need in order to accomplish the work that we are given and we're responsible for. And Governor Plenty was respectful and said, I'm not going to comment in your office because you know what you need, and so I'm here today to ask you for what I need in order to get our work done that the public expects. There's two change items I'm not pursuing today, which was to ask to carry forward some special money that was given to us last session to oversee stimulus funds that came in. We did not use all of them. There's quite a bit left. And I'm going to drop that and say we'll do without it. We're going to work hard to do without that. So that is a sacrifice for us.
What is quite a bit, Ms. Otto?
I don't know if we have the dollar amount today. Do you have it? We can get back to you on the dollar amount today. You know, we're not quite done with our fiscal year, but, you know, there's money left. And so that would have lapsed back because that was one-time money. And then I was going to ask to use it to, you know, carry it forward in a special fund, but I am not going to pursue that because I know that it's very difficult right now. We're asking to not audit Job Z, and so you'll see a negative $82,000, which is a total of $164,000 for the biennium.
And why would that be?
And that would be because when we were given Job Z, it was a locally administered program because we oversee just local government. The legislative auditor oversees state government programs. And when DEED, when Commissioner McElroy was in, he really changed the nature of the program and they updated the contracts and all of that. It's now a state-administered program, and we don't really have authority to go into state government. It would be going into DEED, and that's the legislative auditor's jurisdiction, and we're very careful not to go into each other's jurisdictions. So it's just not our area anymore. And the legislative auditor knows that I was going to recommend that we send this back because we don't do state government. That's outside of our authority. So.
And so what was that total?
That is, I've got another slide on it, but if, let's see here. Where'd it go? Well, it's zeroed out there, but it's $82,000 per year.
All right, thank you.
Not a lot of money, but. Okay, and this next one, again, shows you our divisions. The dark blue is where there isn't an impact in the general fund. Not only do we collect fees for audits, our pension division is partially funded from fire state aid because they oversee fire for the fire relief associations. Tax increment has a statutory appropriation. There's money set aside as these TIF districts are created that funds the oversight of TIF. And so the kind of gray bars are the ones that there isn't any fee reimbursement for. So again, I go back to we're people. That's what our office is. We keep our overhead costs extremely low, which I'm very proud of. And in order to do our work, we have highly trained, sought-after, specialized staff to carry out our responsibilities. In an economic downturn, you need more oversight, not less, because local governments tend to be more vulnerable. We want them to safeguard those funds, make sure they get to where they're supposed to as their taxpayer dollars, and there's a higher level of accountability and transparency with tax dollars. We need to keep the staff that we have currently to get our work done. We have those two change items, and for your information, the impact in the general fund, which I'm sure you're very interested in, just to keep our staff, if costs were to increase, which right now we're using assumptions given to us by Governor Pawlenty. You know, when you plug in your numbers, it said use these assumptions, and so we're using the assumptions he gave us. So it's $19,000 to the general fund for the biennium to keep all of my staff so we can continue to do our work. And then when we get to the Job Z, which is no longer really our area, that has a positive impact on the general fund. And so the net of the two change items we're asking for today, above our base budget or and below, actually has a positive impact on the general fund at the end of the day. So I would respectfully request that you allow us to keep our staff. If you were to cut audit staff, or if we were, and so Senator Daley, I'm getting back to some of your questions. You know, if we were to get rid of audit staff, you guys have to cut the revenue side. So you actually dig yourself a slightly deeper hole. You don't get anything out of cutting our staff. Now, if it's not, you're not, your concern isn't the state general fund, your concern is local governments. I haven't heard clamor from local governments wanting to not be audited by us. In fact, some have asked to come back to us after going to a three-year contract with a private firm. And so, you know, there's a system in place that they can utilize if they so choose to try to do that. And there are some entities. Here's the problem for local governments. You know, some people get hung up on the fees. I've worked with county commissioners, and we work hard with the finance folks in local governments. If they're not ready when the auditor walks in, and now they're required to do much more work to prepare for the auditor to even begin their work. They have to do a lot more now because all the auditing and accounting standards have changed. They transformed in 2007. They got caught flat-footed, some of them, because they didn't have the training they needed. They didn't have the staff that was qualified to do the work. So when an auditor would come in, whether it be us or a private sector, it costs a lot more when the auditor has to come back and leave and come back and leave. When I came in, I said, we're done with that. Counties and cities, you have to be ready when we walk in the door. And we created a worksheet for them. They had to commit to all the different parts we needed to audit, and they had to commit to dates that they would have it completed so we could come in and get the work done. When it's not done on time, they get a comment in their management letter. And so I showed them that I was very serious about the fact they have to be ready, Senator Daley. And then the other part is that I told the county commissioners that were really interested. I did a training for them through AMC, and I said, do you know the tools you have in your toolbox to reduce your audit costs? Because it's the billable hours you put in, whether it's us or a private CPA firm. And they said, well, no, what can we do? So I gave them all the things they can do to reduce their audit costs. And after 4 years of working really hard on this and training and doing all that I could for them, and making sure my staff was efficient as possible, and I changed the structure within my office, they're reducing their audit costs. And so whether it be private or public, they have to have staff that are trained and enough staff to do the work. And my concern is as local governments have to continue to cut, they may not be prepared, and their audit costs can go up. And so are audits fun? No. Do people like to spend the money? No. But it's a part of doing, it's part of spending taxpayer dollars. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
Sato, can you go back to slide 29, please?
Sure.
If you could, please help us all understand those numbers, what those increased costs are going to go to.
Okay. So the $332,000 and the $477,000, we plugged our numbers into BBS. Governor said, here's the assumptions that this works on. So what this is it's actually about, what, like $9,332,000 and $9,477,000. But this is simply the additional monies that we would need to keep our staff. What assumptions that it was based on? Well, MMB knows the assumptions. But initially, the assumptions were we had to assume a certain increase in insurance costs for our employees. Since then, they're saying now there'll be a 0% increase, which is great. So these numbers here are the change. It's the amount I need in additional dollars just to keep the people I have. Now, could things affect that between now and when we actually do business in the next biennium? Oh, absolutely. What happens with contract negotiations with the state? You know, that can impact what we need. I think this is really the top level of what we need. And then you have to look at when we look at our audit fees. We look at the makeup of our staff. Have we had retirements of higher dollar people? You know, what happened with the state contract? What's happened with insurance costs? We only will use what you appropriate to us, what we need. And a lot of the time, we lapse money back. So this is what I need. This is probably the ceiling of what I need to keep my staff. And if we don't need the money, we don't use it, it always laps back to the state.
So the bottom line is you're asking for more money, right? That's true, right? You're asking for more money?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, I'm asking for a greater general fund appropriation, but the impact on the general fund for your perspective in terms of what does it mean to the state general fund, what it means to the state general fund is actually we're going to have a positive impact because we put the money back in. And, you know, any lawmaker I've ever spoken to always says, well, that's kind of a neat deal because it's the ones where you expend it out and there's nothing coming back. We do replace that. We're really more of an enterprise function for government. It's kind of something that has to happen in government. I would love to go to an enterprise fund system and be enterprise, you know, so that we don't have to come back to you. We would come back to you to tell you what we're doing, obviously, but we and how things are going. But right now we're tied into the general fund. Our office was more of an enterprise fund at one point until one of the former state auditors who later became a governor, not Dayton, I think put in some drapes in the office and somebody, a lawmaker, got mad and took the fund away. So anyway, it's probably a better way to go because it's enterprise. But
Ms. Otto, when we look at that increase, is that you have their staff retention. What does that mean? Does that mean that's what it's going to take to keep those that are currently employed, or does that mean that there are new FTEs going to be hired? Break that down for us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a really good question. And what it means is just to keep the people that I have. It's just to keep the people that I have to do the work that I have. And if I can be more efficient, you know, I work so hard to send money, to lapse money back to the general fund when we can. And so, this is just to keep the people I have based on assumptions. So when anybody comes in front of you to present their budget, MMB says, okay, you know, we're going to say, and I don't know exactly what they were, Matt. Matt, this is my budget technology and accounting director, but MMB, and I think there was like no COLA. There were a bunch of different assumptions we all have to use, and I think that, and at one point it was 6-point-something for an increase in insurance costs. I think that's now to a zero. This should be the ceiling. So if you can appropriate this money to us to allow us to keep doing our work, if we end up not needing it, it goes right back to you. We don't expend it. But we also put fees in, too, to cover it because the local governments have to pay for their audits. Does that help, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Senator Daley.
Final question. I do have counties that are clamoring You may not hear that, but I do. And I'll ask again, what is they're asking. They want to know, what is the specific criteria you will consider to allow them to bid out their annual audit?
Ms. Otto?
Mr. Chair, well, that's interesting because there's a process, maybe perhaps under daily I can work on offline with you. They can send a letter to our office to ask, and I think we checked for letters recently, and there hasn't been any, so I haven't heard clamoring quite yet. But if an entity wants to work with us, they're certainly willing to contact the office, and I'm happy. We're happy to try to work with them. But I don't think we had letters last year. So, but let me know offline, and I can certainly talk with you and see what we can.
And just to confirm, you'll allow that,
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Otto.
Yeah, it's based on professional judgment of staff. Sometimes entities are allowed to go out and some are not, and there are reasons why they're not.
Ms. Otto, how many are there at the current time that are
going? Mr. Chair, can I get back to you with that exact number? I'm sorry, we're kind of we're really precise about numbers in our office, which is probably a good thing, but I don't want to give you an incorrect number on the record. So if I could get back to you on that,
that
would be
great. We'll share that.
Sure, no problem. Right. Sure, thank you.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Otto. I really appreciate all the work that you guys do. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Otto, could you tell us, are all of the counties that are being audited by the auditor's office, do those get done by the time that they're supposed to be done by? Or do some actually fall into an area where we're a little bit past when they're supposed to be due?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, you and I are going to have a discussion about that tomorrow, I believe, right?
I don't know. I don't get a chance to see my schedule.
Yeah, we have a meeting, I believe, tomorrow at 2 o'clock, Senator, and we'll be going over that in boring detail. I think it's exciting, but it's boring. Audits. So counties get audited. And I was going to explain this to you tomorrow, but I can certainly do it now if I have time, Mr. Chair.
We have a couple of minutes.
I'll be very quick. You wanted 3 years of numbers, and we grabbed 3 years of numbers. There's been many years the federal government has granted extensions to counties to say, okay, you can be, you can go past the deadline, you can go past the deadline. And that went on for years. They continued that pattern in 2008. When I came in, I'd heard audits were late and, blah, 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 expensive. And so I said, as a manager, what can I do? Well, we've worked on the cost issue and the efficiency issue and communicating with counties and saying, no, you have to be ready, and we mean it. But the federal government, so anyway, I've worked on that in the counties. We said you have to be ready so we can get in and then get out so we can get everybody done because all of you are affecting everyone. 2008, the feds also continued to, and I came in office in 2007. So 2007, feds said you get extensions. 2008, feds, you get extensions, and we don't have any control over that. By the year 2009, the audits for 2009, well, fiscal year 2009, the feds said, you know what, we don't want to give extensions anymore. So they changed their thing. Well, the counties went, what? state auditor's offices, who were struggling with all the new accounting standards, which required quite a bit more work, I said, well, it has to be done. The counties were in better shape in terms of having staff trained. Most are. Not all of them are. Some of them still are short-staffed, and they don't have the resources to train. Most of them were done on time for the nine. And so it's really great for my staff because they want to get in and get out and keep going. They don't like it did not work for them and for our workflow to have to go in and out. So I want to commend the counties who have worked really hard to either, have someone help them with their financials so we can come in and do the work. Because the county commissioners, some of them thought, we did all that. It's like, no, that's your responsibility. We're not allowed to do that. So anyway, that's kind of the story. The feds are looking at even shrinking the timelines tighter. It's 9 months. It's going to go maybe down to six. So the state auditors have been engaged with federal lawmakers because, it's, okay, you're going to do that. What does that mean to state audit offices and everybody else, right? And when local governments are cutting and state government's cutting and even the federal government, are people even looking at those things? Does it make sense to make it tighter? What's the gain and what are the costs? So I always talk about what are the costs. But counties are doing a really good job. I would say it's gotten much better. So I'm proud of that too. There's lots of work. There's other work that we're doing as well. So it's working out pretty well. So thank
you
for asking.
Senator Lilly, yes. And then Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming and talking with us today.
Sure.
I know that we're talking about the budget, but I would like to ask a couple questions or ask a question more on the focus and goals of the auditor's office.
Yes.
And in your goals statement, you talk about the innovation efficiency for the OSA, but also for local governments. And could we talk a little bit about what are some best practices that the 3,300 local governments can apply? How are we measuring those? And what are we doing as a state to help advise local governments to be as efficient and use those best practices, whether they be shared services, comparative or cooperative efforts, or what are we doing in those areas?
Ms. Sotto.
Mr. Chair, and I didn't pay him to ask that question, by the way. That's a wonderful question, Senator Lilly. Our office actually issues best practice reviews. And so not only do we focus on the accountability, transparency, and if there's theft that we follow up and hopefully the county attorneys can charge, but we also issue best practices, and we won a national award for one of them. And what it was helping local governments reduce energy costs. Well, there's best practices around financial stuff, which we're training on all the time, and I have online trainings now. We're doing everything we can to help those folks and producing educational materials, which they really appreciate. But on the, let's just say their costs overall, they have to open buildings, run school buses, whatever, run cars, you know, heat the buildings, and we're in a cold climate, cool their buildings. And so one of the things we did was I came in and said I wanted to leave a legacy. I told my son, I want to leave a legacy for the state that's lasting forever. What can I do? That first one was helping them reduce energy costs. What I was really worried about was local governments going, ooh, those wind generators are really sexy. Let's put one of those up. Well, we don't want those kinds of decisions. We want them to know what's appropriate for your site. Are there best steps to take in terms of if you want to make any improvement, whether it be a lighting retrofit, you know, your heating system, whatever it is, it's an expenditure of tax dollars, and we want it to be wise. And so we put together something for them, whether it be erecting a wind generator, just doing your lights. You know, some people think, oh, we'll get those fluorescent lights, and that'll be good. And that's not really good. You need a lighting audit to find out what kind of fixtures, how many. A lot of the local governments that did this reduced the number of fixtures, have much better lighting. There was one fire department that was way overlit, and they were going to save substantial money. So that's the kind of impact we can have with thousands of units of local government. And we had a statewide conference on that where local governments came and they said, well, what if we don't have any money? Well, we gave them things they could do with no money, and if they had money, what they could do. Okay, second, I'll give you one more, Senator Lilly, if that's okay. We just issued what I think is a nation-leading report for law enforcement. We have property and evidence rooms around the state. And the integrity of property, if it's done right, the chain of custody, puts the bad guys away and lets the innocent folks out. We had some issues with Gang Strike Force, and their property and evidence room was a mess. We have now issued a nation-leading best practices on how do you run a good property and evidence room. Because the public doesn't always know, but it's really, really critical. And we took all the laws and put them in one place. Nobody's doing that for them, and why should they have to do that themselves? They don't have the man hours. Knowing about internal controls, they're about fighting crime. So we created a great manual. It's going all around the state. It is going to raise the level of what we do in Minnesota to a much higher level. And that's what I attempt to do with our local governments is where's the biggest impact that we can have. And so we're always looking for the next one we're going to do, you know, collaboration, cooperation, and government. I serve on the Collaborative Governance Council. And the Council on Local Results and Innovation, developing performance benchmarks for local governments. So I always tell folks I'm willing to serve on those councils, and it's elbow grease, there's no funding. But there's a lot of passionate folks in local government, and then myself as state auditor, where we want to transform government. So I love that role, that part of my job. So thank you.
Follow-up, Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for your work in that area. I do think that this transformational idea, here we are, we have a budget situation. We need to find a way to cut the cost of government at the state level. We're also needing to cut the cost of government on a local level. We really need these best practices in place. It might be beneficial to have sample cities of certain sizes, counties, population, different things that we can compare our local city against a standard city. And where are we excessive, and where are we under the mean or under the median, and how do we help those cities to really look at how they make their decisions, what their decision trees are? I think there's some real opportunities here to help them reduce the cost of government as they're getting less from the state government. So I would encourage us to continue to work in that area.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Senator Lilly on that. That's a great idea. I also wanted to say that I know that your office has done a good job on fraud detection, while at the same time being able to cooperate with local governments and do more preventative things rather than you know, catch me if you can kind of thing. And I think that's due to the wonderful staff you have, and I got to know some of them over the years, and I have never had a complaint about the professionalism or the ability of county local governments to work with your staff, and that your staff was very willing to help them and pursue their goals of getting their budgets right. I do know, though, that about it's been a long time, even before you were there, Auditor Otto, but I did do a study of whether or not it was cheaper for local governments to hire this out. And at that time, which was quite a while ago, it was definitely more expensive for them to hire it out than it was for them to use the state auditor's office. And I don't know if anybody has done that study since then, because it's been years, but it was more expensive, and also there was less of a trust of the public of private entity doing the local government. When the local government hires that entity, even though they pay you fees, you're able to compare and contrast how different people how different local governments are handling their money, whereas a private firm may not have other public entities besides one or two public entities, so they can't really do a cross comparison like the auditors are used to doing in your office. So I just want to tell you, I think you're doing a wonderful job. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
And Mr. Chair, if any of the members on the committee, I know there's some new folks, and I know there's some folks that have been here for some time, and Senator Daley, this would include you as well. If you ever have any questions or you'd like to know information, I make myself very available and would love to meet with you. And if there's something I can help you with in your community, please let me know. Or if you have any brilliant ideas, because no one owns all of them. My next best practice review, I want to quickly tell Senator Lilly, is all around collaboration, cooperation, and government. Some of our governments don't know where to start, and our next one is going to be fairly, hopefully, brief, but to tell them, how do you start the conversations with entities in your area? They don't always know how, because many already do this. Some areas of our state, they don't, and they don't know how to get started. We're going to help them with that. So you're on. You're totally right. So thank you so much for.
We have one more question, sure. And we have one more group that we want to get in here.
I just wanted to mention, Mr. Chairman, this best practices function of the office. I'm very familiar with the local government energy savings examination that they did. In fact, it informed a fairly significant bill that we passed at the legislature last year that developed and set up a program that local governments can participate in to access. Best practices and financing, et cetera. So that was extremely useful. So I'd encourage everyone to go to the website and take a look at some of these best practices studies that they've done that they share with the locals. It is a very important function of the office.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and Senator Dibble, the public actually uses that study. They get a benefit too. Churches will say, we want to do something. They use our study to figure out where to go and what to do and what some of the funding options are. So it's pretty neat. It wasn't just for government. It went a little further, which we're proud of as well. So thank you very much. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Otto. All right, one more to go here. We've got about 10 minutes, and I think this is such a smooth-running organization, we could probably get all the information through. Final item on the agenda is a presentation from the Amateur Sports Commission. I believe Mr. Erickson is here with us today. So if you could please state your name and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I have an opportunity to get in front of you on other opportunities, but I'm here as a volunteer. I have been a member of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission as a board member since 2003. And just wanted the committee to know on behalf of the board that the Amateur Sports Commission is one of the most innovative, entrepreneurial, and cost-effective agencies that the state government has. We're a very small operation. We hold our annual staff picnic in a phone booth. We have three employees. Mm-hmm. We serve over 4 million visitors at the Amateur Sports Facility in Blaine. We just think that the things that this agency does to promote youth athletics and all that that holds for Minnesota's youth is just an outstanding opportunity for us as board members and for the state. But I'm mostly here as arm candy for our executive director, Paul Erickson, who's going to kind of briefly walk you through our budget, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have after he's done with his brief presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm Paul Erickson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. I also want to extend greetings from two senators who are members. Senator Senjum and Senator Langseth are also serve on our board. I think all of you were given this handout. I think this enables me to run through it in about 5 minutes, and then Mr. Chairman will have a couple minutes for questions. As Board Member Carlson mentioned, we have a budget, very small, $260,000 a year. We oversee the state's flagship amateur sports facility. That facility has 4 million visitors a year, more than Target Center, more than the Metrodome, more than XL Energy Center. Statewide, we support facilities that bring in $70 million of economic impact to Minnesota every year. And then we also oversee the Star of the North Games, which goes all around the state. The second page of the handout, our goals have remained the same since 1987. We use amateur sports as an economic development tool. And many people at first glance, their eyebrows cringe up and wonder, how is that done? Well, if we have a hockey tournament in Blaine or a volleyball tournament in Rochester or a soccer tournament in St. Paul, we market those around the country. And so if a tournament has 2,000 kids in it, sometimes half the kids and their families come from another state. And so all that spending equates to $70 million a year. The second goal we have is to create facilities that create great opportunities for Minnesotans. And then we want to be a national leader. For example, many of our facilities host national team training. The hockey facility in Blaine is home to the U.S. Women's Olympic hockey team. You'll see our organizational chart. It did not require a very complicated computer program to deliver that with the three staff. The next page you'll find interesting is this is the history of Amateur Sports Commission funding from the general fund. And as you can see today, we are less than half of what we were years ago, and it continues to trend down. And just a few fun facts. Our board, which has gubernatorial appointees and legislators, many choose not to even take their per diem. Like Joel Carlson here, I don't believe has ever taken per diem to show his support for the board and so on. I myself, for the last several years, do not claim mileage expense because of the tight budget conditions that we have. The other thing, as an example how the agency is innovative, when our budget, we really need around $300,000 to maintain the three staff. When the recommendations went below that, Hennepin County, through the Twin Stadium, is administering $2 million a year of grants. And we had grant-making experience, so we sold our services to Hennepin County, and we receive a contract for them. It enables us to maintain our three staff without those funds coming from the state. So we are receiving several thousand dollars from the county. If you look at the next page with the purple chart, you'll see the facilities that have been funded by the legislature since 1987. And you can see collectively the attendance that those facilities generate. The next page is the economic impact. Now, you'll notice something interesting, that we were going on about a 45-degree increase every year, but then it kind of flatlined. I think part of that's due to the recession. The other part, I think, is that amateur sports is a somewhat recession-resilient economic activity. And you can ask yourselves, in the last couple of years in recession, you may have delayed buying a new car or the new washer. But if you have a child or grandkid in hockey or figure skating, are you going to say, honey, let's take Susie out of figure skating? Very unlikely. So people invest in their kids in good times and in bad. The next page is the history of Star of the North Games. You can see this event has up to 6,000 participants. It has occurred all over the state from Moorhead to Rochester. The next chart has a couple of dollar bills on it. And just to give the big picture reference for all of you, $70 million comes in every year from out-of-state spending. That does not include a family that drives from Wilmer to Blaine. We only count somebody coming from Iowa, Wisconsin, Texas, or Norway, or another place. Of that, the state receives $4.3 million in sales tax receipts that go right into the general fund. I asked the OMB several years ago, what does it cost for the state to pay the mortgage on those 11 facilities? It said approximately $3.8 million a year in principal and interest. There's a $500,000 surplus that the state receives on your investment in amateur sports. And as you know, our annual budget is $260,000. So this area has paid off. And then, of course, there's $60-some million that go to Minnesota restaurants, hotels, and so on. The last page of the handout is the National Sports Center. And you can see that of the 11 facilities, that the majority of the economic activity does occur at the National Sports Center in Blaine, because it's our biggest facility, 4 million visitors, and $40 million of economic impact. So, Mr. Chairman, I breezed through it as quickly as maybe humanly possible. Now, if there's a couple questions, we'll get into your 10-minute time limit.
Do we have any questions? Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, not a question, just a comment.
Sure.
I just think this is one of the best success stories in Minnesota. Remember, it was Rudy Perpich and his vision, and a lot of people would say, you know, all these visionary ideas, and this is one that has been a monumental bipartisan, tripartisan success. I am very personally touched just with my children participating in many events at the Sports Center, Star of the North Games, and where you bring people not only throughout the state, but it's international in scope, and this is not wishful thinking about return on investment. It's there, and when you're out there, it's magic. So, and Paul, you've been there the whole time. Job well done.
Well, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Erickson.
Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Just want to make sure that, you know, we had some interest in some talks on car rental tax. I don't know if anybody, there was a phone call made. I don't know if anybody showed up.